had been published in Russian during the thaw, but Solzhenitsyn's more recent works, Cancer Ward and The First Circle, were banned, and he was increasingly a thorn in the side of the Soviet authorities. The week after the Prague Spring was crushed, Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov met for the first time. Sakharov had come from deep within the establishment, and Solzhenitsyn from without, the scientist in coat and tie, and the writer dressed casually in old clothes. They sat in the living room of a mutual friend, curtains drawn to hide from the KGB. Solzhenitsyn was charmed by Sakharov's tall figure, his look of absolute candor, his warm, gentle smile, his bright glance, his pleasantly throaty voice, the thick blurring of his R's. Sakharov, too, vividly remembered Solzhenitsyn.
With his lively blue eyes and ruddy beard, his tongue-twistingly fast speech delivered in an unexpected treble, and his deliberate, precise gestures, he seemed an animated concentration of purposeful energy.
Both men, each brilliant in his own way, became beacons of inspiration for Tolkachev. In the early 1970s, Sakharov plunged more deeply into the struggle for human rights, taking up individual cases of persecution and forming a committee on human rights with two young physicists. He began broadening his personal contacts with Westerners, a move that infuriated Soviet officials, who had until then treated him with restraint. In June 1973, Sakharov gave an interview to Olli Stenholm, a Scandinavian radio and television correspondent, and his remarks were published on July 4th in a Swedish newspaper. Sakharov was scathingly critical of the Soviet party state for its monopoly on power, in politics, economics, and ideology, and most of all, the lack of freedom. The interview made headlines around the world. The party state took off the gloves. A sustained and ugly press campaign was waged against Sakharov. 40 academicians signed a letter saying Sakharov's actions discredit the good name of Soviet science. Solzhenitsyn, who had won the Nobel Prize in Literature but was unable to receive it in person, urged Sakharov to keep a low profile. The regime was on the offensive against him and the broader human rights movement. But Sakharov could not remain silent. The KGB warned him not to meet with foreign journalists. But days later, he responded by inviting foreign correspondents to his apartment for a press conference at which he repeated his views on democratization and human rights. Meanwhile, Solzhenitsyn's exposé of the Soviet prison camps, the Gulag Archipelago, was being readied for publication in the West. Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn had ignited a fire, and the KGB began to speak of them in the same breath. Yuri Andropov, the KGB chief in September 1973, recommended taking more radical measures to terminate the hostile acts of Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov. In January 1974, Solzhenitsyn was arrested and deported from the Soviet Union. In 1975, Sakharov received the Nobel Peace Prize, but was prohibited from leaving the country to receive it. These events left a deep and lasting impression on Tolkachev. When he later recounted his disenchantment to explain his actions to the CIA, he identified 1974 and 1975 as a turning point. After years of waiting, he decided to act.
I can only say that a significant role in this was played by Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov, even though I don't know them and have only read Solzhenitsyn's works that appeared in Novaya Mir, he wrote in a letter to the CIA.
Some inner worm started to torment me, he said. Something had to be done.
Tolkachev's expression of dissent began modestly by writing short protest leaflets. He told the CIA he briefly considered sending the leaflets in the mail. But later, he added, having thought it out properly, I understood that this was a useless undertaking. To establish contact with the dissident circles that have contact with the foreign journalists seemed senseless to me, due to the nature of my work. He had a top-secret clearance,
Because of the slightest suspicion, I will be totally isolated or liquidated for safety.
Tolkachev decided that he would have to find other ways to damage the system. In September 1976, he heard the news of Belenko's defection to Japan with the MiG-25. When the Soviet authorities ordered Fazatron to redesign the radar for the MiG-25, Tolkachev had a dawning realization. His greatest weapon against the Soviet Union was not some dissident pamphlets, but right in his desk drawer, the top-secret blueprints and reports that were the most closely held secrets of Soviet military research. He could seriously injure the system by betrayal, turning these vital plans over to the main adversary, the United States. Tolkachev told the CIA he had never even considered selling secrets, say, to China.
"And how about America? Maybe it has bewitched me, and I am madly in love with it," he wrote. "I have never seen your country with my own eyes, and to love it unseen, I do not have enough fantasy nor romanticism. However, based on some facts, I got the impression that I would prefer to live in America. It is for this very reason that I decided to offer you my collaboration."
Tolkachev was usually at his desk at Fazatron by 8 a.m., but he did a lot of his best thinking outside the office. He often had an inspiration at home or sitting alone in the early evening in the Lenin Library. He jotted down notes, then took them to work and copied them into a special classified notebook, which was turned over to the typing pool. His desk at the Institute was in a large room on the fifth floor with 24 other persons. Fluorescent lights hung from a high ceiling. In front of him, two women sat facing away. On his desk, he had two phone lines, one for internal calls, extension 159, and a city line, paper for taking notes, a notebook with a list of problems that needed to be solved, scrap notebooks for rough sketches, and reference works on radar. A file drawer held a set of papers about work schedules and copies of official notes he had sent to other institutes. Another drawer held electronic assemblies and parts needed for final checks of equipment he had worked on. With secret documents tucked inside his coat, Tolkachev's walk home at lunchtime was easy and pleasant. The city's streets in 1981 were broad, but traffic was light. He often left the Institute and cut through a neighborhood of boxy apartment buildings latticed with interior courtyards and small parks. He turned onto Novopresnenskaya Pereulok, a small lane, passing a kindergarten and a playground. Then he took Volkov Pereulok, a quiet back street that ran next to the Moscow Zoo, and his high-rise apartment loomed just beyond. It took him only 20 minutes to get home. The apartment was empty at lunchtime. He took out the Pentax camera, clamped it to the back of a chair, positioned a lamp nearby, and made copies of documents. One day, in 1981, Tolkachev was careless. When finished, he usually stowed the camera and clamp in the entresol, where they would be well hidden. But he hastily left them in a desk drawer. They were discovered by Natasha, and she immediately guessed what Adik was doing. She confronted him when they were alone. Her concern was not the damage to the Soviet state. She hated the system even more than Adik did. Her lament was more personal. She did not want the family to get hurt in the way that her parents had suffered. She did not want to bring the wrath of the KGB upon them. Tolkachev confessed to her. She demanded that he stop his spying, to spare the family any difficulty, and he promised to quit. But he did not. Chapter 14. Everything is dangerous. David Rolfe had not seen Adolf Tolkachev for 8 months. Tolkachev was not using the kitchen light, the Svet signal they had agreed upon to show that he was ready on the planned dates for a meeting. His kitchen window had been dark. On November 10, 1981, the next meeting date, Rolfe went to the selected site,
a park not far from Tolkachev's apartment building, and was relieved to find him waiting by the fountain. Rolf walked briskly down the flight of stone steps and greeted him warmly in the chill air. Tolkachev, his face brightening, said he had bought a car and motioned to Rolf that they should go take a look at it. A moving car was a risky place to meet an agent. Rolf would have no control of where they were going. A parked car wasn't great either. It could attract the attention of a curious onlooker or militiaman. There was also the Druzhiniki to worry about, a government-organized neighborhood watch that wasn't always vigilant, but whose members, wearing red armbands, might knock on the car window and demand identification. Still, there was no point in discouraging Tolkachev. He had a childlike excitement in his voice. They walked toward the car, talking, catching up. When Rolf mentioned Tolkachev's silence over the last few months, saying the Moscow station had been watching the kitchen light, Tolkachev interrupted him. He hadn't wanted to meet in September. In October, he did want to meet and signaled on the proper day by parking his car near the market, as Rolf had suggested. The CIA gave him a map and instructions for the site, designated Mashina, or car. Park opposite the market, between 12:45 and 1 p.m. Back into the parking space, rear tires against the curb. Go shopping for 15 minutes. Tolkachev followed the instructions exactly, but Rolf didn't show. Tolkachev had assumed the reason was an incident he had read about in the newspapers. In September, the KGB ambushed a Soviet citizen while meeting an American and accused the American of being a spy. Rolf knew of the arrest. The station had indeed lost an agent, and a case officer had been expelled. But he reassured Tolkachev that wasn't the problem. The real reason was that Rolf didn't think the Mashina site would be operative until November. He simply hadn't checked it. He apologized for the confusion. They reached Tolkachev's compact Ziguli, tucked in between other cars parked closely together. They climbed in, Tolkachev behind the wheel. Rolf was thinking to himself that this might not be a very smart move, but they had a lot of business to do. Tolkachev was relaxed, in good spirits, and he seemed to feel like talking. Before long, Rolf noticed the windows were fogging up. It was like this at the start of every meeting. Tolkachev was a bundle of anxiety, but had no one to share it with other than his case officer. He needed a release. Tolkachev passed 23 rolls of film to Rolf, fewer than last time, but potentially carrying hundreds of pages of secret documents. One of Tolkachev's Pentax camera bodies was not working properly, and he returned it. Rolf handed back a spare Pentax camera body. He remembered to bring it because of the 6 rolls of blank film in March. Rolf also presented Tolkachev with a new set of stereo headphones and music for his son, and a package containing 32,400 rubles. Rolf explained that he brought Tolkachev a new secure communications device known as an IOWL, or Interim One-Way Link. The gear included a commercially purchased shortwave radio, a smaller electronics block called a demodulator, and one-time pads. When Tolkachev tuned in to certain shortwave frequencies at specific times with the demodulator attached, messages could be downloaded secretly. Tolkachev appeared intrigued. In one of his first letters to the CIA, he had proposed using a modified radio for transmitting secret messages. At first, everything seemed fine, but as they talked, Rolf realized it was not. The Institute had once again imposed strict procedures on checking out secret documents. As before, the new rules required that Tolkachev turn in his building pass. Tolkachev glumly informed Rolf this meant he could not take documents home to photograph, which he had done so successfully for 2 years. The CIA's attempts to replicate the building pass had so far not satisfied Tolkachev. The colors and the paper were not quite right. Tolkachev said he tried and failed to make the discus work over the summer.
He handed the device and instructions back to Rolf. He didn't appear to be frustrated. He had experience with electronics and understood that things could malfunction. Rolf was far more skeptical. He thought the Discus device had yet to contribute a single ounce of positive intelligence. After the missed signals, Tolkachev proposed a new way to indicate that he would be ready to meet. Instead of the kitchen light, the CIA should look above the main window in his apartment, at the small hinged window used for ventilation, known as the Fortochka. They were common in all Russian buildings. On a meeting day, the Fortochka would be open for a short period at midday if Tolkachev was ready. Rolf asked twice, "Are you sure it will be visible from the street 9 floors below?" Tolkachev assured him the open Fortochka appeared as a black square above the reflected glass of the main window. Tolkachev had personal requests, too. He wanted the CIA to provide him with a pocket tape recorder, information about recent events in Poland, and My Life by Leon Trotsky, which was banned in the Soviet Union. After 20 minutes, Rolf climbed out of the car and said farewell. Tolkachev drove off. It was his 11th meeting with the CIA. He said nothing to Rolf about his wife's discovery of his spying, or his promise to stop it. The next morning, back in the station, Rolf opened the ops note Tolkachev had given him. Of the 45 questions the CIA had posed in March, Tolkachev had offered answers to only 11 and was apologetic. He wrote that his access to information was not unlimited, and he felt sorrow that he could not respond to the wide themes the CIA had asked about. Tolkachev said he couldn't possibly answer technical questions about weapon systems, "with which I am not directly connected." Rolf suggested to headquarters that they needed to be more careful about the questions. He expressed worry. They were trying to overload Tolkachev in areas where he has no hope of meaningful response. After 2 years of prolific production, Rolf said they ought to do better than 11 out of 45 by tailoring the questions to topics Tolkachev might know about. But the demands did not slacken. In the autumn of 1981, Gerber flew back to headquarters and met Casey, the new director of Central Intelligence. Gerber had devoted much of his career to espionage against the Soviet target, and he was the kind of operations officer that Casey admired. In a letter to Reagan, after becoming director, Casey confided a feeling that, "I get better intelligence judgments from the streetwise, on-the-ground operations people than the more academic analysts at headquarters." During their conversation, Gerber remarked the Soviets were a nuclear-armed superpower, but an economic basket case. "This is a country that can't even make toasters," he said. "And while they can make missiles, they can't feed their population." Gerber was drawing on his own experiences in Moscow, but Casey waved him off. Casey said the Soviets were advancing in Latin America and Africa, and they had to be confronted everywhere. Reagan campaigned in 1980 on a promise to stand up to the Soviet Union, and he was now turning the promise into action. At the Ottawa summit in July 1981, President François Mitterrand of France told Reagan some startling news. The French intelligence service had been running a secret and highly productive agent inside the KGB, a 48-year-old colonel, Vladimir Vetrov. The operation was still underway. Vetrov had turned over to the French 4,000 pages of KGB documents about a global effort by the Soviet Union to steal high technology from the West, especially the United States. The KGB had a whole section, known as Line X, to carry out the heist. With Mitterrand's approval, the French brought the documents to the CIA. The papers, known as the Farewell Dossier, showed in remarkable detail how the Soviet Union had hijacked Western advances in electronics and other technology to benefit its military machine. With Reagan's approval, Casey launched a covert program in cooperation with American industry to rig hardware and sell it to Soviet buyers, matching the KGB's shopping list, including contrived computer chips and faulty turbines. At the top of the Soviet list was oil and gas equipment to control a huge new gas pipeline to Europe. When the pipeline technology could not be purchased in the United States, the KGB bought it from a Canadian firm. With Reagan's approval, the CIA engineered it to go haywire after a while, to reset pump speeds and valve settings to create pressures far beyond those acceptable to the pipeline joints and welds. The system exploded. The result was the most monumental non-nuclear explosion and fire ever seen from satellites in outer space. The farewell dossier was run right in Moscow. It reinforced something the CIA had concluded while running Tolkachev. It was possible to carry out penetrating spy operations under the nose of the KGB. Tolkachev surprised the Moscow station by signaling on December 7, 1981, that he wanted to meet right away. Rolf went to see him the next evening at 9:05. Tolkachev was chagrined over the new security restrictions at the Institute and his inability to produce more documents. He gave Rolf 6 rolls of 35mm film, far fewer than in the past. Tolkachev seemed distressed. He implored the CIA to once again make an attempt to replicate the building pass. Tolkachev offered to loan his building pass to the CIA so they could make a copy, saying he would not need it during the January holidays. Rolf resisted the temptation to take it, thinking there was no way to return it by the end of the month. Rolf reassured Tolkachev that the CIA was willing to be patient and gave him 4 books by Soviet dissidents. They were together only 15 minutes. It was the last time they would ever see each other. Tolkachev's 6 rolls of film developed beautifully and included the material that had been lost in March. Also, the 23 rolls of film he delivered in November carried a list of all the technical documents that had arrived in the secret library of the Institute for the second half of 1980. This was valuable intelligence, showing the state of Soviet advanced technology, but not quite as revelatory as his earlier documents, which contained blueprints of specific weapon systems. A cable from headquarters pointed out, "The value of the recent acquisitions, while of considerable import, generally does not equal that of sources' earlier detailed documentary reporting on the Echelon, Gorizon, or Shmel systems, some of which project Soviet R&D activities off into the mid-1980s to mid-1990s. Tolkachev seemed to be running out of targets for his espionage. Nonetheless, to encourage him, the CIA broadcast a secret message to Tolkachev on the interim one-way shortwave link, telling him the December film had processed perfectly. Tolkachev never got the message. He hadn't turned on the shortwave. Rolf held a cover job in the defense attaché's office at the U.S. Embassy, with the formal rank of attaché, but the KGB knew he was an intelligence officer. Still, Rolf evaded them, handling 2 major operations, CK Utopia and CK Sphere, using surveillance detection runs, out-of-country scenarios, identity transfer, the SRR-100 radio monitors, and a blend of planning, patience, stamina, and good luck. He had benefited greatly from the mentoring of Hathaway, Gerber, and Gilscher. Perhaps most important, Rolf had earned the confidence of Tolkachev. He became a welcome and familiar face, listening to the spy's concerns and fears and building a personal bond of trust. In early 1982, the Moscow station launched a shift in tactics away from Rolf's traditional case officer function, working all angles, building trust with the agent, to something different. The new approach was conceived by Gerber, the station chief, when he first arrived in Moscow. It called for adding to the Moscow station a new capability, a few case officers who would be under deep cover, totally invisible to the KGB. They would be black all the time, and therefore more secure. This would be accomplished by putting the deep cover officers in innocuous cover jobs, with day-to-day routines that would lead the KGB to pay them little attention. Most of the CIA's case officers in Moscow were under some kind of official cover, usually as a diplomat in the embassy or as a defense attaché, but they also spent a great deal of time in the Moscow station working on espionage operations. By contrast, the deep cover officers would keep a healthy distance from the Moscow station. They would not have desks or type up reports there, nor participate in the important and lively discussions in Gerber's office. Despite the high stakes and constant risks, they would be rookie CIA officers on their first tour, who had never been seen by the KGB anywhere else in the world. To preserve their deep cover, they would come to the Moscow station very rarely, and then only briefly, through a secluded entrance. The station would communicate with them using impersonal means such as dead drops, water-soluble paper, and intermediaries. All the hassles would be outweighed by one big advantage. They could evade surveillance. Deep cover operations in Moscow were begun only after lengthy preparations and bureaucratic wrangling in Washington. The CIA had to negotiate with other agencies, primarily the State Department, for clean slots, jobs that had never been used for intelligence personnel before. The State Department and the CIA, as institutions, were often at odds. Diplomats had long resented the spies in their midst, and the State Department hated to give up precious overseas slots to the CIA. Only a few people, including the ambassador and the chief of station, would know who was under deep cover. Headquarters arranged for the first deep cover officer to go through foreign service training, so he would look just like a State Department employee. The first deep cover officer arrived in Moscow in the summer of 1981. And after a few months of preparation, Gerber wanted to put the new arrangement into action. He sent the officer to meet Tolkachev on February 15, 1982. Tolkachev carried a recognition signal, a book with a white cover, in his left hand. He greeted the new officer without any hesitation. It was 9:05 p.m., and they climbed into the Zhiguli. The officer delivered to Tolkachev four replicas of the Institute building pass made by the CIA for him to examine, and also handed him the discus device once again, reassuring Tolkachev that it had been checked out in the CIA's laboratories, and this time it would work. The CIA package for Tolkachev included a charger for the shortwave radio, a schedule of Western broadcasts in Russian that could be received on the radio, the Trotsky autobiography, information about the crisis in Poland, a small portable cassette recorder, batteries, more positive intelligence questions from headquarters, and a note of effusive thanks. "Your courage is truly an example to us all," it said. Although meetings with deep cover officers were intended to be brief, Tolkachev didn't know that, and he wanted to talk, as he had so often done with Gilscher and Rolf. He complained the CIA had used a wrong exchange rate to calculate his ruble payments, and he was owed much more. He said he needed film for the Pentax. There was a shortage in Moscow stores, and they would sell him no more than 5 rolls at a time. He wanted the CIA to provide him with 100 rolls. Tolkachev also acknowledged he hadn't turned on the shortwave radio and demodulator to receive the CIA's secret messages. He was uncertain whether he could pick up the broadcasts, and he had no privacy at home in the evenings. He said his family still didn't know of his espionage. Despite these setbacks, Tolkachev said he was determined not to quit. He handed the deep cover officer a schematic diagram and another circuit board. Only the second time he had provided the CIA with a valuable piece of Soviet electronics. Then he gave the deep cover officer 13 rolls of film. Surprised, the CIA officer asked how he was able to do that if there were restrictions at the Institute. Tolkachev said he had a friend in the First Department who would occasionally slip documents to him on request. "Isn't that dangerous?" the officer asked. Tolkachev laughed.
"Everything is dangerous," he said.
3 weeks later, on March 8, 1982, the Moscow station received a signal from Tolkachev, saying they should prepare for the very first transmission by Discus. As Gerber had anticipated, the station was forced to scramble. The station had already cased several locations, known as electronic letter drop sites. One envisioned Tolkachev transmitting across the Moscow River, with a case officer receiving the signal a few hundred yards away at a train station. The Moscow station wanted enough distance so as not to arouse the KGB's suspicions. While the station didn't know why Tolkachev was getting in touch, the CIA prepared a message anyway to send him in reply, saying the last rolls of film were perfect and they would pay him a lot more rubles. The first successful Discus message from Tolkachev wasn't earth-shattering. Tolkachev wrote that he was eager to provide feedback about the CIA's four replicas of his building pass. They were too light, and he wanted an unscheduled meeting in 3 days. On March 16th, the deep cover officer went out to meet Tolkachev. It was 9 p.m. in Moscow, and Tolkachev was in good spirits, but worry creased his face. The security restrictions at the Institute had been ratcheted still tighter. Now it was impossible for him to get any documents from the office, nor could he get them from his friend in the First Department. He had no film to give the CIA. Desperate and unhappy with the CIA's four replicas of his pass, Tolkachev gave strips of colored paper from the inside pages and a strip cut from the cover of his building pass to the officer.
"Take that back to the CIA," he said, "and let them make the replica from this."
The officer urged Tolkachev to be careful and not to take any risks. Tolkachev seemed restless, but also more introspective than in the past. The case officer wrote afterward to headquarters that Tolkachev admitted that he had been careless early on in his relationship with us and agreed not to attempt further document photography until they could work out some of the problems. Tolkachev really seemed to pause and think about the need for caution. The meeting was quick, just 15 minutes. The next day, the Moscow station opened Tolkachev's ops note. He reluctantly presented a wish list of more personal favors: a Sony Walkman for his son, and earphones with a loop across the head, as well as pencils of various hardness for Oleg's mechanical drawing. He also wanted some Polish blades for his safety razor, writing that,
"Shaving with Soviet razor blades is an unpleasant experience."
He apologized for asking for such trivial things, noting,
"Unfortunately, our personal life consists of all types of small things which sometimes exert an influence on the general mood."
Gerber knew what he was talking about. The Soviet Union could make missiles, but not toasters, or safety razors. On May 24th, two case officers went out on the street separately for a meeting with Tolkachev, hoping that one of them could get free from surveillance. Both carried identical packages. One of them succeeded and met Tolkachev at a site near his apartment building at 9:35 p.m. The case officer delivered a bulky bundle: 20 packages of razor blades, 40 rolls of Western film that the CIA had repackaged in Soviet boxes, a Sanyo M6600F tape recorder, a Sony Walkman, a headset, extra batteries, and 26 boxes of drawing pencils for Oleg. The bundle was so large that at the last minute, the Moscow station had removed another 20 rolls of film. They needed space to wedge in 98,850 rubles. The package also included a new replica of his building pass. Over the summer of 1982, Rolf finished his tour in Moscow and went off to another assignment, In late September, Gerber also departed for a new assignment at headquarters. His farewell included a small gift from his colleagues in the Moscow station, a trophy-sized numeral 1, with a metal sphere hanging off the front. It was a memento of the big 1 that had been left on the station door when Shymov was exfiltrated. The sphere was a reference to Tolkachev, the agent known as CK Sphere. It became a tradition from then onward that the Moscow station put a numeral 1 on the door if a major operation was completed successfully. That summer, Bill Plunkett arrived in the Moscow station to run the Tolkachev operation. He had been an athlete at Boston College, playing varsity baseball and soccer, and still enjoyed tennis when he could find the time and a court. Plunkett had thrived in assignments when he could meet and recruit people. Moscow was his first taste of denied area operations. But as a Soviet specialist, he thought there was nothing better than wrestling the bear in his own cave, as he put it. Plunkett was intending not to be Tolkachev's case officer, but to coordinate all aspects of the operation from the station. Then, in his first months, the operation seemed to be sliding into serious trouble. At the time, the Moscow station was sending deep cover officers out to meet Tolkachev, sometimes two or three at a time. But then 5 scheduled meetings passed without a successful rendezvous. Plunkett felt the tension grow slowly. A missed meeting or two had happened before, but not 5. By December, the station was fraught with anxiety. In all the previous meetings, the Moscow station had made strenuous efforts to see Tolkachev in a safe environment, as certain as they could be that there was no KGB surveillance. Case officers had aborted a scheduled meeting if they had the slightest inkling of surveillance. Now the stakes were higher than ever, and Plunkett began planning for a meeting with Tolkachev, no matter what, even if everyone on the street had surveillance. They would have to make it work. The Moscow station was a tense place under any circumstances, a small cockpit of high achievers. But at this moment, the pressure and stress brought them together. None of them wanted Tolkachev lost on their watch. Plunkett took upon himself the job of meeting Tolkachev. He realized if they lost touch with the spy, it would be an enormous setback for the CIA. If he made a mistake on the street that led to Tolkachev's arrest and execution, it would haunt him the rest of his life. From the files, Plunkett felt he knew Tolkachev well. A middle-aged man with short, quick strides that made it seem as if his feet barely made contact with the ground. The others who had met Tolkachev told Plunkett not to worry. The agent was a real pro. He would take care of the meeting. Just let him do it his way. Plunkett also read that Tolkachev had a remarkable ability to just melt away. He looked like Mr. Everyman. After using the jack-in-the-box and jumping from the car on the night of December 7th, Plunkett spotted Tolkachev. The spy looked just as he had been described, nondescript in a fedora, a brown overcoat, brown gloves, black shoes, and a gray scarf tucked inside his overcoat. They met as snow blanketed the city. They exchanged a verbal password. "Come on, let's walk," Tolkachev said. Plunkett's immediate impression was that Tolkachev looked worn and tired. His voice sounded a bit tense. Plunkett also noticed that Tolkachev looked older than the photograph he had seen. Tolkachev mentioned that he had been bedridden, suffering severe bouts of high blood pressure. But this had not deterred him from checking out top-secret documents from the library at his institute, then photographing them when alone at home with the Pentax. As they walked, Tolkachev spoke faster, describing new security procedures he faced. Tolkachev was undeterred, as determined as ever. Plunkett spoke in Russian, explaining why they had missed the earlier meetings. They had spotted KGB surveillance. Tolkachev abruptly stopped in his tracks and looked at Plunkett wide-eyed.
"You have surveillance?"
"No, no," Plunkett responded. He meant on previous evenings. Tolkachev was relieved. They walked. Plunkett realized every word was important and asked if he could turn on a recorder. Tolkachev said yes. Plunkett switched on his concealed tape recorder so the voices could be replayed later at the Moscow station and headquarters. They traded packages, film, batteries, and books for the agent, 16 rolls of exposed film for the case officer. As they were almost finished, they heard a crunching of boots on the snow. Tolkachev and Plunkett glanced anxiously at a tall senior army officer in uniform walking toward them. They froze. He walked right past, and they exhaled. After just 20 minutes, they parted. When Plunkett glanced back to make sure Tolkachev was all right, he had melted away. Plunkett walked back to the wide Moscow boulevard known as Garden Ring Road and boarded a bus. He sat in the very back, behind all the other passengers. He took off his Russian coat and eyeglasses, then reached into the sack, grabbed his American street clothes, and put them on. It all happened very fast, just before the bus stopped, and he jumped off. No one had seen him, but he was still apprehensive. What if the KGB was now out looking for him? Two militiamen stood by the door at the embassy, as always. When Plunkett saw another American return from walking his dog, he rushed in close behind. He walked to the apartment of two colleagues and silently handed them the package from the spy to be brought to the station in the morning. Plunkett couldn't speak. The apartments were probably bugged. But he signaled thumbs up and accepted a whiskey in a water glass. He felt a surge of relief and exhilaration. The CIA attempted repeatedly to replicate Tolkachev's building pass, down to the delicate indigo swirls on the paper. At last, Tolkachev said the most recent replica, given to him in May, was good enough. For several months in 1982, he used it to smuggle documents out. But suddenly in August, the Institute's security procedures changed yet again. Now there was an entirely new pass for checking out documents. The CIA forgery, so long in the making, was rendered useless. It is now extremely difficult, if not impossible, for CK Sphere to take documents home, Plunkett reported. There are special permission slips which CK Sphere could use, but extensive use of these slips would surely cast suspicion upon him. Plunkett wrote that his visceral feeling was that Tolkachev is concerned due to conditions of work and health, that life is getting tougher, and that perhaps his best days are behind him. Plunkett's observations threw the CIA into a fresh round of uncertainty. In a cable to headquarters, the Moscow station described a confluence of factors weighing on Tolkachev. The new security rules, his mental state, and the fact that he was thinking about copying documents with much riskier means, such as the concealed Tropel cameras. Headquarters responded by saying perhaps they should ask for a 6-month timeout to give Tolkachev a breather. The Moscow station agreed. The station said Tolkachev seemed concerned about his security when he talked with Plunkett. If he sees danger signs, and we think he does, it is possible they are more ominous than he is ready to admit, the station told headquarters. The film Tolkachev passed to Plunkett on December 7th processed perfectly. Another 499 pages of secret documents. For a spy who had saved the United States billions of dollars, Tolkachev's personal requests remained modest. His son Oleg had entered an architect's training institute, and drafting equipment in the Soviet Union was poor. Could the CIA find a better quality set in Eastern Europe or the West? Even the erasers in Moscow were shoddy, Tolkachev complained. They left greasy marks on the drawings. Could the CIA find 4 or 5 better quality erasers? Czech erasers have pretty good quality, Tolkachev wrote. My son has been able to obtain half of such an eraser from acquaintances, and we are using it now, but it won't last him for long. He also wanted two or three large bricks of Chinese dry black drafting ink, and three or four high-quality drawing pens. Tolkachev informed the CIA he would accept precious valuables in lieu of cash, which he had previously rejected. Soon after this message was received, Thomas Mills, head of the USSR branch in the division, got a most unusual assignment. He and his wife Joby were asked to go to New York and find some valuables for Tolkachev, with agency money. Joby, who had studied art in New York City, was thrilled. They went to A la Vieille Russie on Fifth Avenue, a jewelry and antique store established in 1851. In the elegant shop, the CIA official and his wife bought a very small but pricey Fabergé pin and a heavy gold necklace. They brought them back to headquarters for shipping off to the Moscow station in the pouch. Mills was told that if any questions arose, Tolkachev would explain that the jewelry had been left to him by his mother. The worry about Tolkachev after Plunkett's meeting with him led the Moscow station to think again about whether it might be necessary to suddenly exfiltrate him from the Soviet Union. By early 1983, the station had written up a detailed plan to remove Tolkachev, his wife, and their son. The CIA had done it in Moscow only once before, with Shaimov, his wife and their daughter, although exfiltration had been successful in other countries. The CIA had even built special containers for smuggling people, but there was no enthusiasm at headquarters for exfiltration of Tolkachev. The Moscow station plan landed with a thud at Langley. The station was getting ahead of itself, headquarters advised. Exfiltration with the family would be a soul-searching question for Tolkachev, and had not even been discussed with him for more than 2 years. Nevertheless, the station was undeterred, perhaps out of an abundance of caution. Two plans were drawn up, one long-range and the other for an emergency. The station composed a long personal questionnaire for Tolkachev, to be delivered at the next meeting, asking for passport photographs and probing Tolkachev for clothing measurements, medical history, locations of his friends and relatives, vacation procedures, and methods for calling in sick at work. "Is your family aware of our relationship?" the CIA asked. "If not, how do you plan to tell them?" They did not know that he had already promised his wife he would quit spying. Deep cover had become an essential method for CIA clandestine operations in Moscow. But the work of a deep cover officer was far different from what Gilscher and Rolfe had experienced. They had been advisors and confessors to Tolkachev. In contrast, deep cover officers worked at a distance from the station and from the agent. It was lonely, stressful, and risky. Robert Morris thought the relentless pressures of the job and the isolation were more like being an undercover cop. Morris arrived in Moscow carrying a briefcase, and his documents identified him as nothing more than a State Department bureaucrat, one of the unremarkable administrative workers needed at the embassy. He played that role to the hilt, but he had arrived for a different purpose. He became the second deep cover officer assigned to the Moscow station, hoping to fulfill his ambition to be at the forefront of the Cold War struggle against the Soviet Union. Morris, son of a high school sports coach who'd grown up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, attended an all-boys New England college prep school and went on to Georgetown University. Restless at the university after just one semester, he left the school and volunteered for the draft at the peak of the war in Vietnam. A gung-ho soldier who thrived in 3 years of hard training, he rose to become a first lieutenant in the Special Forces, second in command of a Green Beret A-team, one of the most elite military detachments in the world. He was assigned to serve in Vietnam in 1971, but the war began to ebb, and he did not go. During all the rigorous training, airborne, underwater, and jungle warfare, Morris got to know an intel sergeant who had emigrated from the Ukraine and shared fascinating stories of life in the Soviet Union. Morris was drawn to the mystery of it all and took Russian language lessons. When he left the service in 1972, he returned to Georgetown University to study Russian and play football. Morris dreamed of adventure. After graduation and knocking about in business for a few years, he was recruited by the CIA. When he arrived at headquarters in October 1980, he had just turned 30 years old. His hair was fashionably combed across his forehead, and he wore aviator-style glasses that gave him a modish look. Morris completed his training in the top echelon of his class. He arrived in Moscow in early July 1982. After he spent months carrying out his job as a bureaucrat, the KGB swallowed the cover story and lost interest in Morris, and he was ready to begin espionage operations. Before a meeting with Tolkachev, both Gilcher and Rolf had spent hours planning in the station. But as a deep cover officer, Morris was on his own. When he sketched out a surveillance detection run, he had descended to the station by the cumbersome equivalent of an inter-office dead drop, usually writing it out on water-soluble paper and emplacing it discreetly, such as sticking it with a magnet on a fire extinguisher somewhere inside the embassy, to be picked up by another case officer, and the process reversed when the station sent him an answer. He experienced very little of the camaraderie of the Moscow station. He did not write letters to the agent. He did not prepare packages. He just delivered them. When there was an operation to be carried out, Morris went to the station for a brief meeting, no more than 10 or 15 minutes, taking a secret entrance. He memorized his instructions, and when there was a package disguised as a brick or a log, he put it in his briefcase and carried it back to his cover job in an administrative office full of Soviet employees, where he would sit tight, never daring to take his eye off the briefcase until he could go home. His role was to be the perfect courier. The KGB overlooked Morris for many months as he moved about Moscow, filling dead drops for the station's various operations. He had to watch every word and every action. It was like acting on a stage constantly for months and months on end, never forgetting a line. The spring of 1983 was exceptionally busy. One night, in an unprecedented feat, Morris placed 2 dead drops in a row in distant locations, without the KGB's catching even a glimpse of him. But Morris felt isolated. He had no way to let his hair down. He had to live his cover as a bureaucrat, and that meant no discussion at home either, even though his wife had participated in most of the nighttime runs. After months of clandestine activity in which he escaped KGB notice, Morris drew a far more sensitive assignment: to meet Tolkachev in person. On March 16th, he set out on a long surveillance detection run by car, by bus, and then on foot. Because his cover was that of a State Department bureaucrat, Morris did not wear the radio scanner that had helped Rolf listen to KGB transmissions. It would be awfully hard to explain if he were caught. Without the radio, he would have to make a judgment call about surveillance on his own instincts and observations. 2 hours later, free from surveillance, he reached the planned site, a streetcar stop. 12 people were waiting. Morris was excited. The adrenaline was rushing through him. He met Tolkachev after dark and walked to Tolkachev's car, parked at a nearby apartment building. Inside the car, Morris felt tense, but Tolkachev was calm and behaved as if he had been doing this forever. They handed each other packages. Morris gave Tolkachev a note that brought up exfiltration, outlined how the operation would work, and included the questionnaire. Tolkachev handed over to Morris 17 rolls of film and a very long ops note, 42 pages. The materials included surprising new intelligence about a target recognition system being developed for the MiG-29 fighter. Morris thought Tolkachev looked good. His morale seemed high, and Tolkachev smiled when Morris presented him with the architectural drawing materials for his son. Morris said the CIA wanted to get answers soon about exfiltration, in April, if possible. Although Tokachev hesitated, he agreed to a meeting in early April. They said farewell to each other after only 12 minutes. Once he got home at 10 p.m., Morris left the rolls of film in his coat pocket. He did not want to take them out, in case the KGB had a concealed video camera in the apartment. Late that night, he slipped into a closet in his apartment, curled onto the floor, and by flashlight, wrote out a memo by hand on water-soluble paper to the Moscow station, describing the meeting and what he had seen. This was the work of a deep-cover operative, hiding in the bottom of his closet. Tokachev's ops note revealed that he had been through three crises of high blood pressure and was feeling exhausted. "It has become more difficult for me to work intensively. I tire much easier," he said. While in the past, he would often go to the Lenin Library after work and quietly spend a few hours there, he said, "I am not always able to do that now." He asked the CIA to find some ginseng root, which he had heard was a stimulant, and a Russian organic medicine. The note also contained another list of personal requests, primarily books for himself and his son. He wanted materials about Western architecture, not only with photographs, but also with English text, to help Oleg with his language skills. Tolkachev asked the CIA to find topical detective stories for his son, saying they were being passed around in paperback by his friends, whose parents bought them abroad. Tolkachev requested more books about the Soviet Union that were factual, not polemics. His curiosity centered on the years of Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Stalin period, when his wife's family had been so brutally repressed. "Generally, an objective interpretation of the history of the October Revolution and Russian life in the 20s and 30s would definitely interest me," he wrote. He told the CIA he had devoured Trotsky's memoir, My Life, but was less interested in some of the other more propagandistic books about the early Soviet years. He added, "I am interested in the memoirs of famous world political and military figures, writers, actors, artists, architects, etc." He asked for books with all kinds of political views, progressive and reactionary, and also wanted the most important speeches, appearances, declarations of Western political leaders, which were often unavailable in the Soviet Union. Tolkachev said his wish list included the following. 1. Bible, in Russian. 2. Booklet, published in Washington, about Soviet military power, preferably in Russian. 3. Reagan's speech in which he mentioned Lenin's 10 principles. 4. Memoirs of Golda Meir. 5. Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, in Russian. 6. Solzhenitsyn's book, August 1914. At first, headquarters was glad to hear from Morris that Tolkachev seemed to be in good shape, and immediately began gathering all the books he asked for. "Absolutely delighted to hear that C.K. Sphere is his old self again, in good spirits and improved health, and apparently raring to get on with his work for us," headquarters cabled to the Moscow station on March 22nd. But a closer look at Tolkachev's long ops note told a different story. The station sent back a message within hours, saying Tolkachev, a driven man, was struggling with his health and was pushing himself hard. The station was also puzzled about the rolls of film Tolkachev had brought Morris. If the security restrictions were so tight, and he had not reported any change, how was he able to shoot 17 rolls of film? On April 1st, headquarters reported the film had been developed and printed with excellent results, including approximately 525 pages of secret documents. We use the word approximately because there are multiple fold-out pages of diagrams, headquarters reported. In any event, another good job by C.K. Sphere. Tolkachev had promised to give the CIA an answer about exfiltration, and signaled for another meeting on April 23rd. Morris went and found him at 8:55 p.m. This time, because a group of children were playing noisily near Tolkachev's parked car,